I really think that these midterm elections are so imperative, because if we don't get some gutsy Democrats in there to regain control of one of the houses, how can we impeach this monster? He has the White House, he has the Senate, he has the Congress, and then he definitely has the Supreme Court, as we've all been watching. So my question is to the panel is, what's the likelihood of impeachment if we don't win back these houses in the midterm elections in 06? Thank you.
There are a number of answers to that. The most fundamental one, I think, is that we all have to learn to stop predicting and being spectators and sitting up in the stands and becoming amateur pundits, as we all have become. We have to be citizens. We have to act to make change. We have to do what is our duty, come what may. That being said, I think that we are very likely to want to win a majority, and the way that the Republicans got the majority was not by being scared and whispering about what they might do if they ever had a majority. It was by going out and speaking on behalf of their base and letting themselves be called radicals and giving people an understanding of what it would mean for them to have a majority. And so the Democrats who tell you, oh, it doesn't make sense to talk about impeachment, we're in the minority. Well, it doesn't make sense to talk about any issue right now for the Democrats. Just go home, you know, if you're going to talk that way. Don't pull that out just on this issue. If you want to win a majority, look at what Democrats around the country want. We want to end this war. We want to impeach this president. We want single-payer health care. We want a serious energy policy. We want a shift in spending from this black hole of unaccountable military waste into something useful. And if you can't talk that way, they're not going to get a majority. The other thing you hear about impeachment is, well, we really need to focus on ending the war. The reason that people oppose this war is because we've exposed the lies it's based on. You know, so there are some exit strategies that make a lot of sense, and they're very detailed. The simple one, I think, is four parts. One, get the majority. Two, impeach. Three, aggressively pressure President Pelosi to get the troops out. And four, stick the soldiers on airplanes and lift off. There's an educational purpose and a political purpose in having the investigation, in having censure, in having this kind of talk, in fighting for impeachment whether we get it or not, and it's our responsibility as citizens.
What are our chances? That's my question. Do we have a chance, Dave?
Yes. Nothing has ever been done. On Thursday, Harry Reid said, I'm not a senator, I'm a pundit, and I've counted heads, and we can't have a filibuster. Look at Feinstein, she won't filibuster. Cindy Sheehan said, hey, Senator Feinstein, if you don't filibuster, I'm running for your seat. Within 3 hours, she was filibustering. We have a choice to observe or to act. We cannot do both. We have to stop observing and act.
Let me respond to that also. You know, there's a lot of things that the American public believes in, from their civics classes in elementary school, balance of powers, checks and balances, and believe it or not, Republicans agree with those values as well. And I think our job as advocates is to make President Bush radioactive by bringing out the truth about what he has done, how he has misled, how he has lied, how he's deceived the American public, how he has broken the law over and over again. We need to make this an issue that Republicans care about as well, because it's an American issue. The Constitution is not red or blue. The Constitution stands for a real government of checks and balances, and it's time to bring that back into focus. So I don't think we should assume all Republicans will oppose us. You can see Republicans change their views. Walter Jones, for example, who was well-known from a congressman from North Carolina, known as Freedom Fries Jones because he wanted to change the names of French fries in the Congress, now opposes the Iraq War because he was lied to. He's a conservative evangelical from the South who supported the war. and here he is opposing the war. So I wouldn't give up on all Republicans. And I want to also comment one other point you made, which is that you fought for freedom, and I appreciate that. And I think that's what most veterans and most active duty soldiers are doing. And you look at what we're talking about now in Congress with this current Patriot Act, and I think we need to shudder. The old Patriot Act was bad enough with its secret searches of people's houses, with the monitoring of medical and financial records, with monitoring of library books we read. The new Patriot Act has some provisions that need to really frighten us all because they are a direct affront on our freedom of speech. The new Patriot Act includes provisions that make it illegal to carry an unauthorized sign at the Democrat or Republican convention. What is the Congress doing protecting the Democrat or Republican convention to begin with, but then denying an unauthorized sign? Secondly, makes it illegal, a crime, to carry an unauthorized sign if the president or vice president are speaking. And finally, it calls for the Secret Service, by the way, which is expanded now. It's no longer just protecting the president. The Secret Service is becoming the Secret Service Uniform Division under the Homeland Security, and they now have the power to define at other events where unauthorized signs are a criminal offense. So our Constitution is under attack. It has passed the Congress, the House. It's being filibustered in the Senate. Many Democrats voted for it in the House. And so we have some serious problems. We need to create the vision of a country we want and work for that vision. Forget the party labels. Individuals are what count. We need to stand up for what we believe in, and we'll get there. Let me see if there's any other comments on this side of the panel.
I just want to reinforce one thought, and that is it'd be a serious blow to the impeachment movement to politicize it. It's not a political issue. It's a constitutional issue, basic. And let's go for everybody. Jefferson said at the height of the Revolutionary War that human nature is the same on both sides of the Atlantic, which is a pretty courageous thing to say. He called hell for it. But human nature is also the same on both sides of the aisle in the House of Representatives. And we need to fight to get every member on each side to start this country over again, because we're in deep trouble.
Very good. Next question.
Thank you, Mrs. East. I think that you'll make the finest U.S. senator we've ever had.
You've got to get there first.
But my question is this. You're all wonderful people, and I thank you for having us today. We know that impeachment's going to be difficult at best. I'm wondering why we're not talking about the elephant in the room, so to speak. The elephant in the room is this. Mr. Clark, fine humanitarian lawyer. The Association of Humanitarian Lawyers right now are looking at grounds for prosecution for treason for the use of depleted uranium. It's radioactive. It is in our munitions, in our guns and tanks. And it's something we're not talking about. And it could put these very same individuals behind bars where they belong. I'm wondering why we're not talking about that today. Thank you.
You know, I think we have to move on all fronts, so to speak. We only have war language, war on poverty. It's deeply ingrained in our character. But I think that there is no remedy that approaches impeachment in its international and domestic meaning. It means finally we stood up. It's not a prosecution. It's not a technical thing. It's not what some state legislature did or the District of Columbia did. It's we, the people, standing up through our elected representatives in the House of Representatives, saying our policies have been wrong, and we're going to warn all future elective officials that they better not try to do the same thing. We're going to remove the ones that are in there now from office, and then we'll be believed.
And specifically on the issue of depleted uranium, that certainly is something that the United States has to be held accountable for the injuries, the long-term suffering that we've caused by the use of those, not only to our own troops that are exposed to them, but to the civilians in the areas where we've used them. In the former Yugoslavia, the bombs that we've dropped there, Gulf War I, I mean, it's a horrible, horrible problem. The use of chemical weapons in Iraq right now, the use of white phosphorus. There are a lot of counts that will go into this whole issue of war crimes, and depleted uranium and use of chemical weapons and things like that are certainly a part of it. Thanks.
Let me make one other point about depleted uranium. I think that's important. You know, it's interesting how we're trying to tell Iran that they can't have nuclear power, and we're spreading radioactive material all along their border with our nuclear waste. And, you know, whenever we enrich uranium, depleted uranium is one of the leftover products, and it causes a problem for storage. It's a dangerous substance. And so, you know, I think one of our methods of avoiding the storage problem is to spread it all over countries that we decide to bomb. And you know, the hypocrisy of us, you know, talking about nuclear weapons in space and spreading depleted uranium across the across of Iraq, refusing to cooperate with the UN to clean it up, refusing to do the studies necessary to see how dangerous it really is, I think just shows the real problem with the inconsistency of our government. So I think your depleted uranium is a very important point. I think it's potentially a serious war crime that's not being addressed at all and needs to be covered more by the corporate media as well. Thank you for your question.
I want to address two, I think, simple questions, and probably not, to Attorney General Clark. First of all, I agree with you entirely. By way of introduction, I'm Johannes Williams. I'm a member of the D.C. Bar and the Supreme Court Bar. I understand your distinction between a war of aggression under international law and the war powers that the president is trying to claim at this time. But we don't have a de jure, a legal war. We have attacks and invasion and occupation. I'd like to ask you to explain how that plays out in the impeachment process, the distinction between an international war crime of a war of aggression versus a claimed war that empowers war powers rights of the Article II presidency and the reality of the attacks, invasion, and occupation. And the second is I'd like to have your views, please, on why the United States did not support the International Criminal Court.
I'll go to the international court first. Tragically, it's as simple as this. George Bush doesn't intend to be accountable to law, international law or domestic law. But he will not. I mean, the way we have coerced and bribed, it's an obstruction of justice under any criminal code of any nation on earth, because you have to protect the judicial function, to interfere with the judicial function. We've coerced country after country to sign a bilateral treaty in which they pledged themselves never to surrender an American citizen to the International Criminal Court. So if George Bush wants to go to Paris, he won't be arrested there and surrendered to the International Criminal Court. And we ought to stand up and say we're a part of the humanity of this planet, and we stand equally with everyone here, equal sovereignty and equal individual rights, neither above nor below. And we'll be accountable for what we do. International crimes are crimes under the Constitution of the United States. It's as clear as anything in the Constitution that they're a part of the supreme law of the land under Article 6. The Congress does not have the power to enact a statute that would support a war of aggression. The United Nations doesn't have the power. The Security Council doesn't have the power to say we're going to authorize a violation of this crime. If they had the power, then they're above the law. And we can't tolerate that. So we've got a lot of cleaning up to do. As bad as depleted uranium is, I remember the first infants and children and bodies being brought in from Bedouins in the southern parts of Iraq with tumors and deformities, the fetus or the child actually born, that people had never seen. And finally, it took 2 years to figure out it was depleted uranium. And it's bad stuff. But it's nothing compared to the nuclear weapons that are on the planning table and well toward actual production. A new generation of nuclear weapons that this country is authorizing and developing. And the difference between them and the hydrogen bomb and the 5-megaton super bomb is that they'll be used. They're being developed so they can be used. You can take out 6 discrete blocks in Fallujah, you know. You don't have to send Marines in. And while we're developing those here, while we have the overwhelming majority of all weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear arms, while we have by far the most sophisticated systems of delivery, and they're kind of hard to carry around, our nuclear sub-fleet, the Trident II, can destroy any city on Earth at any time. We've got a dozen commissioned and at sea at any moment. We have to come to grips with the threat that we are on weaponry across the board. And what we do is coerce countries through that. We want every individual and every institution, including the Congress of the United States and the President of the United States, to obey the fundamental laws of society. And wars of aggression are the supreme crime against humanity.
Kevin, may I put one more question? As a diplomat, in my last assignment in Mongolia, that was in the era when the Bush administration was putting the heavy hand on all countries to sign Article 99, that the United States citizens and government officials would not fall under the International Criminal Court. And the threats and the, if you don't sign, we're going to take your economic aid away from you, your military aid away from you. And this was going on all over the world. And I was so proud of the Mongolians for the longest time because they very diplomatically were telling us to shove it, that we would study this. We'll study this and study it and study it. And finally, it was the ultimate, the final thing, and one of the reasons that I resigned. I mean, and there have been plenty of reasons to resign before, but, you know, when indeed it's just blatant, in your face, if you don't do what we tell you to do, we're taking everything that we offer to you away. So this is a very nasty regime that's pulling every trick in the book on the world.
To Bush, truth is what he wants people to believe. You know, he'll go to New Orleans and say what a miraculous recovery they've made. But if you go to New Orleans and see the place is still a disaster, half the people hadn't come back. They haven't even identified 3,000 dead people yet. And he dares to say it's a miraculous discovery? He says the economy last year was wonderful. Never had a better time when real wages dropped and the income for the majority of the population dropped. On the 19th of this month, after the third of five judges originally on the Saddam Hussein court resigning specifically because of political pressure on them, political pressure from the United States, political pressure from various sectors of the body politic in Iraq. And when there had been a couple of wild scenes in the courtroom, President Bush setting up a nice little scene of some Iraqi families, very well dressed, allegedly victims. And he said, the trial of Saddam Hussein is on track. Well, it was the last thing in the world from being on track. He was having to say it was on track because people could see it wasn't on track. And then he went on to say, the butcherer, I didn't think that was a word, and I looked it up in Webster's Unabridged Third, and butcherer is not there. Murderer is there, but butcher, a butcher's a guy that cuts meat, and it's also a guy that trashes human bodies and things. But he said, the butcherer will get his just due this year, which means execution. That's what he wants. He tries to say from time to time that Saddam Hussein tried to kill my dad. Well, he'd been trying to kill Saddam Hussein for quite a while. He began, shock and awe, with super bombs directed, and they claimed they got him for a while, you remember? And on the last day of shock and awe, they claimed the outskirts of Baghdad that they got him that time. Folks finally got out there and dug around. They couldn't find him. He wasn't there. So here he's trying to say about this trial that it's got to speed up and it's on track. The next day, this fellow, Raed Jui, who's been the principal spokesman, he was a Bremer appointee. He translated for Bremer. He was part of the judicial system that we put in place. Comes up and says, the trial will be over in 2 months or less. And, of course, it's been chaos ever since. They try to create truth by saying things that are false. And we've got to stop falling for that. We've got to go forward with trials that are real and where they're necessary and that are constitutionally ordained and where fairness is the priority.
And I like your idea of talking to neighbors, family, congresspeople, and that's what I love to do. Could you all tell me a web page I can go to with a one-sheet talking point with the legal impeachable charges specific? Does that exist on a one-page form talking points for this for me?
There are several websites. Do you want to give some?
Yep. There's one website called www.bushcommission.org that has a list of six indictments and various counts under each one of the indictments. And that website will be having evidence that was presented at the commission hearing last weekend that will be posted on that. And there are other tribunals and commissions that have been set up that each one, you know, has a variation off the theme. But quite honestly, the Congress isn't going to have to do much investigation. The people have already done the work for them. So that website has some of them, and just check www.bushcommission.org.
Let me say that www.impeachbush.org has a the original bill of indictment was over 2 years old. I drafted it, and we've reformed it to include new acts. They're up to 19 or 20 now, and they're specific. The website also includes a history of impeachment, how during the Revolutionary War, Hastings, the Governor General of India for the British, was under impeachment, how critically important it was. There are more provisions in the Constitution for impeachment than for any other single issue. There are seven specific, separate references to impeachment. They're all outlined in the website. And then it has the history. There's a terrific history major book by 12 prominent American historians. It was put together during the effort to impeach that caused him to resign, Richard Nixon. And it has the full history. But impeachbush.org, which has the 600,000 votes for impeachment, we need 6 million more, has that history too.
The other two websites to mention would be afterdowningstreet.org and also democracyrising.us. If you just Google impeachment on either one of those, you'll find all the information you need on that. Let me stop the questions for a moment and welcome Cindy Sheehan, who has struggled to get here. I interviewed Cindy about a year ago, Memorial Day, before she was the famous Cindy Sheehan. I think what I found in Cindy was an incredible honesty and earnestness and fearlessness. As the spotlight got hotter on her and the heat got hotter on her in Crawford, we saw that she was the calm in the eye of the storm there. It was quite an amazing sight to behold. And
thank you. We have all been hurt by this war. Some of us have been hurt more than others. You know, there's tens of thousands of innocent Iraqis who are dead because of George Bush's lies. I've met people all over the world who have been affected by the lies. I met a mother in Spain whose son was killed in the terrorist bombings on the train. I met a mom in Spain whose son was killed in the Palestine Hotel. He was a journalist, by a rocket aimed by our government, by our military, killed Jose. I've met moms in the United Kingdom whose children have been killed in this war. And I met this young man in Venezuela. He's from Mexico, but he lives in Venezuela now. And he came up to me after I had done an interview. He works for one of the television stations. And he was crying. He said, "Cindy, 3 months ago, my mother was killed by a soldier in Oklahoma who had just gotten home from Iraq. He was drunk and he was suffering from PTSD. So I've met people all over the world who have been devastated by George Bush's lies. And it's not just George Bush. George Bush is the tip of the iceberg. I believe that anybody who said anything about Saddam and WMDs, who said anything about faulty intelligence, who said anything about a connection between Saddam and 9/11 should be investigated and impeached." And then we need to, after they're impeached, they need to be removed from office, and they need to be tried for crimes against humanity. I don't want revenge. I don't want any kind of, I'm not doing this out of a bitterness or for revenge. I have a friend here, Bill Mitchell. His son was killed the same day Casey was killed in the same ambush. Bill, have you been recognized?
No.
Well, I recognize you, Bill. Hi, Bill. He's one of the co-founders of our organization, Gold Star Families for Peace. His son, Mike, was killed in the same ambush Casey was killed in. Casey had only been there 5 days, and Mike only had a week left. And he was the only one in the 1st Armored Division killed that day, and 7 soldiers in the 1st Cav were killed, and Casey was one of them. But we don't want revenge. We just want to see justice. That's all we want is justice. We want somebody held accountable for all the sorrow and heartache that has been, you know, forced upon the world by the lies and the deceptions and the agenda of our government to spread the cancer of empire and, you know, for oil and for making the war machine richer, for the corporatism of the world. And that's all we want. We just want justice, and I don't think that's too much to ask. But we need to go and walk the halls of Congress and say, you know what, this is not an issue of right and left. This is an issue of right and wrong. And it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or a Republican. You did not raise your right hand and swear allegiance to the president or your party. You raised your right hand and you swore to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States. And that's what you finally have to do. My son and Bill's son took that same oath. And we're not going to rest. We're not going to let them call the Constitution a piece of paper. We want justice. We deserve justice. And we need to force our elected officials to be accountable. And we need to elect the elected officials who will uphold the Constitution and defend our rights. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Cindy. So we have time for a few more questions. So.
Looking back over the last 50 or 60 years of American history, I'm hard-pressed to think of a war that we didn't get into on the basis of lies. Can we make the case that the lies that got us into the present war are qualitatively different than the Gulf of Tonkin incident of the Vietnam era or the unendangered American medical students on Grenada? Or the incubator baby fabrication of the first Gulf War, or the gross distortions of the Dayton Accord, which justified our aggression against Yugoslavia.
This is a super lie. The others were lies too, and that those administrations should have been held accountable.
There's one clear difference between this war and the earlier ones, which, by the way, went back long before 60 years ago. I think of the spot resolutions that caused Lincoln's defeat on re-election to the House of Representatives and justified the American invasion of Mexico, the Mexican-American War, which we took more than half of Mexico, the rich part. We'd already taken Texas, where I come from. But the difference between this war and all the others is it's now. It's also a time when American power is more dangerous than the concentrated power of any other country in history. The only thing that I see other than violence that can control it is the will of the people, and that's our duty. And it's a very high duty that should be the first priority of everyone who cares about children and life on the planet, to impeach this government and never let this happen again.
I would just add that in this case, we have such strong evidence of such a blatant and comprehensive campaign to lie to us that we have a greater percentage of the American people much more quickly aware that this war is based on lies. And so, you know, we still have evidence coming out now about the lies of Vietnam. We have about this current war so much more quickly, so much more authoritative evidence, and we have a majority of the people aware that this war is based on lies. We are very, very far from having a majority of the people aware that all of the past wars were based on lies, and we have many people who still see this as an unusual mistake, not a crime, and are ready to commit another one in Iran. So we have a responsibility to build on the opportunity that's been thrown at us of a country that is aware of a war based on lies and needs to be made aware of the pattern and the need for once to cut it off and hold somebody accountable.
My name is Matt Vanright, and by way of introduction, I'm a former Vietnam veteran with Marines in Vietnam. I'm a former UN weapons inspector in Iraq, and I'm a certified victim of weapons of mass destruction. My question for the panel concerns, and I want to say that impeachment is the highest poll in my personal tent, but I want to ask the panel about the many facets on the jewel of accountability, and that is, I wish to address the accountability of Congress on the issues of abrogation and reassignment, if I can use the term, of their powers of using armed forces to support foreign policy to the executive. And there have been some cases in the U.S. history concerning the abrogation and reassignment of powers. And I'd like to ask the panel about their feelings, but before you answer, I'd like to read a couple of quotes in that direction. The question whether such a delegation of legislative power is permitted by the Constitution is not answered by the argument that it should be assumed that the president has acted and will act for what he believes to be the public good. The point is not one of motives, but of constitutional authority, for which the best of motives is not a substitute. The second quote is, when the president is invested with the legislative authority as the delegate of Congress in carrying out a declared policy, he necessarily acts under the constitutional restrictions applicable to such a delegation. I'm sure nobody knows where those quotes came from, except probably General Clark probably does. But these were, this is a payback quote. These were issued by Chief Justice Charles Evans Hughes in the famous cases involving the overturning of the NIRA in 1935, when President Roosevelt was slam dunked in his efforts to overcome the effects of the Great Depression. And so this is a backfire effect, I believe, in this issue of abrogation and reassignment of powers, this time not interstate commerce, this time the powers to use armed forces to affect foreign policy.
Number one, the thing that we always forget now because we're so wrapped up in everything else is that George Bush's presidency is illegitimate. He was selected by the Supreme Court. And even if we believe that he won 2004, there was many election irregularities and there was many, voter manipulation and voter fraud and voter suppression. So really, I would like to change the discourse from impeachment to eviction. We don't have a separation of powers anymore. All our power is concentrated in one party. We don't even have the media helping us as a fourth estate. So we have to, as members of our democracy, exert our rights and responsibilities in our democracy so we don't lose it.
Let me make one comment on that. If you look back at our Constitution, you'll see there's about 40 paragraphs on congressional power and congressional responsibility, how Congress is chosen, et cetera, and about 5 paragraphs on presidential power. Originally our Constitution was designed as the powerful legislature with a very limited executive. James Madison said one of the most important elements in the Constitution was the power to declare war. And he made it very clear that in commenting on that, that important power, that they had lived under King George and they had seen what one monarch can do as far as sending troops at his whim. And therefore, they didn't want to give that power to one person. Unfortunately, our Congress has not exercised that power, and they in fact shy away from taking responsibility. I think that's a serious shortcoming. Similarly, I think they shy away from taking responsibility when it comes to the advice and consent function of the Senate in picking a Supreme Court and confirming Supreme Court justices. So I think we have a real warped sense of how our government's supposed to operate. We're not supposed to have a monarch. We're not supposed to have a king. We're not supposed to have an imperial presidency. And so I think it's very important for the legislature to begin to take back its power. And finally on that, on the point of constitutional power, there's nothing in the Constitution about political parties. In fact, our founders were concerned about political parties because they thought these factions would do more harm to our country than anything else. And so I think it's important for us to stop thinking as Democrats and Republicans and break outside of this two-party straitjacket that we've gotten ourselves into, especially when you look at the funding of both parties. The military-industrial complex is funding both parties consistently. And as a result, we're not going to be seeing challenges to the military-industrial complex that is eating up half of our discretionary income.
So I'd like to see Congress reaffirm its authority, and I'd like to see us move away from voting based on party affiliation and start voting for candidates based on what they stand for. And the one thing we need to do is vote for what we believe in, not vote for what we fear. Let's start to envision the world we want and vote for what we believe in. Keep voting for what you don't believe in. There's one guarantee. You'll get what you don't believe in. So it's time to start voting for what you believe in. Any other comment? Other questions?
Hi there. My name is Brian Vargas. I'm a D.C. resident. It seems to me, I've heard a lot about accountability and the will of the people. It seems to me that the first opportunity for accountability we had was in the last election. And whether or not we elected him the first time, and whether or not, regardless of voting irregularities, there was much more clearly a majority of voters who elected him the second time. What is the vision for this panel? What do you see as being different for the impeachment process when half of even just the voters may or may not agree with such a decision?
On that question, you know, Richard Nixon won by a landslide and then was impeached. So elections are not the determining factor in whether or not a president is violating the law. And the question is really a legal question. If the president is violating the law, he shall be impeached. And that is what it comes down to. So I don't think the election is a determining factor of that. But I'll let other people comment on this, particularly Davis, who's done a lot of polling on this question to see where the public stands.
Well, just to be clear, I haven't done the polling, but paid polling companies to do it, and they do it the way they do it, and we see how it comes out. Back in August and September of 1998, there were 16 major polls done about impeaching President Clinton. On average, 36% of American adults supported hearings to consider impeachment, and 26% supported actual impeachment and removal from office. What a popular uprising, 26%, and yet we had to watch Kenneth Starr walk to the end of his driveway to get his newspaper every day. We had saturation coverage. We had all the major newspapers asking Clinton to resign. This was something the public did not want, but the media wanted, and it happened. Now we have the reverse situation. The media doesn't want it. The impeachment wasn't in the corporate media in any major way until the past week. When ABC was good enough to ask Al Gore what he was talking about after his speech, which notably avoided the word, when Senator Spector said impeachment is the proper remedy for the sort of crime Bush may have committed, when Bill O'Reilly has been forced to talk about it by his callers, when Knight Ritter has an article on impeachment that's been in 100 papers, when the Dallas Morning News has written an article with some falsehoods in it, because they quoted a guy from my alma mater, University of Virginia, Larry Sabato, as an expert. I haven't seen him in a single event about impeachment, but he's an expert. And he said, oh, well, that just scares people off. It's only the hardcore partisan Democrats. So I sent the reporter at the Dallas Morning News the following information. Zogby International, October 29th to November 2nd, margin of error 2.9%. American adults, 53% agreed and 42% disagreed with the statement, if President Bush did not tell the truth about his reasons for going to war with Iraq, Congress should consider holding him accountable through impeachment. We had a very similar question that differed in that it said, if President Bush wiretapped American citizens without approval of a judge, we got 52% to 43%. We have similar results that Ipsos got. Most of these have been done by Zogby, and almost all of them we have had to pay for. And there is a serious problem, not just with media coverage of this issue, but with the media's polling arms refusing to do any polls. And you can go to afterdowningstreet.org if you want to help harass them, because their excuse used to be, it's not being talked about, it's not in Congress. It is being talked about, it is in Congress. If they want to question these results, I'd like to see every polling company in the country go out and ask the question.
All right, let's take a series of questions. Let's take a series of questions now. I'll try to keep them short. Take a series of questions, then we'll have the panel comment on all the questions together and see where we, you know, and end the session that way. Go ahead.
I'm Marcia Jansen with Democracy Rising. And my comment is this, in reference to our responsibility as we, the people, in this impeachment process. It has to start in the House of Representatives. They are all up for re-election in November. We have so much leverage and force right now. We don't even have to wait until then to back candidates who are in favor of impeachment. What we have to do right now is just get on the phone and demand from the Congress, members of the House of Representatives that are there now, that we want this president impeached. And we, it's going to be hard to say what I'm going to say next because I know this is a room filled of activists. But whatever it is we're doing, we have to do more. I was hoping that Ralph Nader would be here this afternoon, but it looks like maybe he's not going to make it. But Mr. Nader says that we the people, we the citizens of this country, must focus like a laser beam on Congress to demand what we want, the end of the war, and in this case, impeachment.
Hi, Jim Marks, D.C. State of Green Party. First of all, thank you, all of you, for giving us the information you have. Most of this forum, and maybe most of the audience, is concentrated on Bush-Cheney's crimes with regard to the Iraq War. But, of course, we're aware of, and it appears to me that the even more certain and more likely case for impeachment is the over 200 discrete infractions of the FISA Act under their program of warrantless surveillance of American citizens, which is an offense that is truly nonpartisan, as domestic spying is as anathema to honest Republicans as it is to independents and Democrats. So considering, my question is, that considering that each infringement of the FISA Act under Title III, Section 1809 of U.S. Code, calls for a specific penalty of up to 5 years in jail and $10,000 fine per infraction, which means that at over 200 counts, that Bush and or his attorney generals are on the hook for up to $2 million in fines and 1,000 years in prison, correct?
Bush had a press conference a few days ago, maybe 4 or 5 days ago, one of his few press conferences, and he was asked, why do you think it's okay to just ignore the FISA law? And he said with this evil sneer, that was written in 1978. So what does he think of a document from 1789, right? Right? He's made it very, very clear to us. And I think it is absolutely the case that we have to, in every conversation about this, talk about morality, talk about the harm that was done to so many families like Cindy's, and talk about what it means to commit the greatest international crime. Because if I come to your house and break in and I bust up half your furniture, I do not have a moral responsibility to spend the night. And if I convince the cops to let me stay, there is no more law, right? And if you attack me in your house and I kill you in self-defense, I am guilty of murder because I was occupying your house, right? I have to get out, I have to restore a legal order, and I have to submit myself to it for my crimes. That is where this has to start.
While people are talking about November of 2006, there's going to be another 800,000 American soldiers killed. Who knows how many Iraqi people killed? We don't know. We don't keep count. You know, George Bush a few weeks ago, you know, said, oh, I don't know, 30,000 innocent Iraqis. Well, even if we take his estimation into consideration and say, okay, it was 30,000, on September 11th, one of the most tragic days in American history that we'll all never forget, 3,000 Americans were killed. So does that make George Bush 10 times a bigger terrorist than Osama bin Laden? You know, so this is what we have to focus on. You know, yes, we have elections coming up, and yes, if the Democrats don't seriously screw up, and I'm not holding out any hope for that, we might take the House back and we might be able to have an investigation and call for articles of impeachment. But we can't wait till 2006. This is what I'm saying. We have to go and we have to demand that our Congress do their jobs. You know, we're using depleted uranium in the Middle East. We're using white phosphorus in Iraq. We're torturing people. We're flying them in airplanes and torturing them. And I've gone all over the world. I've talked to high officials in governments. And they've said, oh, you know, we can't denounce the United States because they're our friends. I'm like, but you don't support your friends in doing illegal activities. You know, so this is a morality question. The invasion and occupation of Iraq does not fit any standard of just war theory, if you want to look at morality. And if you want to take it even a step further, any killing to solve any problem is barbaric. You know, killing is wrong and it's immoral. And it is, and this occupation of Iraq is illegal by all other standards. So that's what you have to talk to these Congress people about. And I know it's frustrating, trust me. You know, I've done a lot of this, very frustrating. You know, but we've seen some good things happening since August. We've seen them come out more and more. We saw Jack Murtha turn around. We've seen a lot of good stuff happening, but they're not going to change unless we make them. And like the woman said first, we don't have to wait till 2006. We can say, if you don't start doing your job, you're going to lose it. And we can start putting pressure on them that way because they care about money and they care about their jobs. We're sending our kids over to fight, die, and kill innocent people in an illegal and immoral war, and they're coming home and they can't get help. And this is tragic. So we have several members of Gold Star Families for Peace whose children committed suicide. You think they come home, okay, but I'm telling you, this war is so immoral, and war is so nasty, and war is so terrible that every one of our soldiers that goes over there dies. They don't come home the same person that got sent over there. And while they're sending our kids over to die, fight, and kill innocent people, they're cutting back VA benefits for them. And, you know, this is just another hypocrisy of this administration who says we don't support the troops. We want them to come home alive. They don't support them in any way. And the number one thing they're not supported in is they're over there in the first place. Thank you.
Cindy for the Senate.
I think our most important challenge is focus and priorities. To me, an immoral law is a law in name only. I have no respect for it. Morality needs to be the foundation of all law. And the legal philosophers for 2,000 years that you read, that I respect, have all recognized that. Aquinas said an unjust law is a law in name only. Forget about it. You know, it's just an arbitrary intrusion on the freedom of an individual. I'll talk about FISA for a minute to bring my views into focus. I've probably been picked up on more FISA conversations than virtually any other American citizen.
Sue him.
And I've opposed wiretapping since I was an adult, and if I'd known about it, I'd have opposed it before. Because it's an intrusion on the privacy of the individual, and that privacy is where character develops. If you don't want to have character, don't have privacy. FISA doesn't bother me that much. I would hate for the people of Iraq or Afghanistan or any place else to think that the only concern the United States had was prosecuting the president for violation of FISA of American citizens when we've committed a war of aggression. If we don't stop the power of the United States to commit wars of aggression, even if the Congress itself declares the war, then we have failed. And it's the greatest danger. Everything else follows from it. And while there are other matters that need to be included, importantly, the celebration of torture, it's more than condoning. We insist on it. I don't know how it came to be. I couldn't imagine leadership in the United States condoning or fostering torture. arbitrary arrests. I mean, we just pick people up. Their families don't know what happened to them. They don't know where they are. They may not know who they are when we get through with them. We hold them for years. We junk them. That's about as contemptible of human dignity as anything you can do. It's a form of torture in and of itself, even if you don't engage in physical torture. It has to be included in the package. But we have to send a message to the world that the people of the United States have rejected what their government has done at the most important levels and won't permit it to happen again. Yes, we have to reform the Congress. We have to elect people that will act in truth and justice. But I think Robert Jackson had it right in a case called Youngstown Steel versus Sawyer, adjudicating the power of President Truman to seize the steel mills during the Korean War. He said the Congress has let its powers slip through its fingers, and only the Congress can repossess them. When you look at this Congress now, it's paralyzed. There are very few that would dare to reach out to grasp the powers that Article 1, Section 8 vests in them, which includes the power to declare war. It includes all the war powers. I mean, from the raising of the first penny to arm the country and protect the country, to the regulations of the military services. That's another reform, but until we control the executive's abuse of power with this huge military and violent capacity that we have. We wrote a book back in, I think it's probably 94, I mean, called Medal of Dishonor, M-E-T-A-L of Dishonor, a trick title like most titles. But it showed the statistics on depleted uranium, which is a terrible thing. So Italian military lost 8 soldiers to depleted uranium very quickly in Kosovo. And probably 10,000 people have died in Iraq. Very cruel deaths from depleted uranium. But nothing compared with the war of aggression, and couldn't have happened without the war of aggression. So we have to eliminate as best we can weapons of mass destruction. We have to convict for the attack on civilians, which has been common. We have to convict for, and which of course is a violation of the Geneva Conventions, and we have to convict for indiscriminate bombing, which we do all the time. But above all, we've got to stop the beginning of the war, and we've got to cut the military budget by 75%. I used to say 90%, but I'm older now and don't have the courage to stand up to these things. The first question had to do with focusing on the House of Representatives, and I think that's critically important. Focusing on the incumbents, recognizing, making them recognize. When you go by to see your congressman, try and take a petition with 250 names from her district, his district, they'll understand then. But also where you have to, try to get candidates out against them. We've got to start before the primaries to build up people who will have as a priority impeachment. Right. We've got to show the world that the people of the United States oppose what their government has done. Then we've got to liberate ourselves and the country from this plutocracy of George Bush's, which is a government of, by, and for the wealthy, and stop U.S. militarism.
First, regard to the returning vets and PTSD, I think one of the great shames of George Bush and of the Congress is undercounting of U.S. casualties. You know, the figure 15,000 U.S. casualties is out there, and it's a figure that the Democrats and Republicans both use. It's a false figure. It's a false figure. When vets come back from Iraq, 30% come back seeking medical help. There's been about 400,000 plus troops in Iraq, so we're talking over 100,000 vets who have been injured in Iraq. So this 15,000 figure is one that we should stop using and start recognizing all these vets who are suffering as a result of this war. So we need to get a real number there and not this phony propaganda number that the Bush administration is successfully putting out. Second, with regard to colleges, I am also finding colleges to be active and interested.
despite there not being a draft. And I think that I think when Ramsey Clark is right about cutting the defense budget, if we face up to the military-industrial complex, which is not an easy thing to do because they are well-organized and well-funded and they've done their job of buying candidates quite well, but we need to challenge that system because it's half of our discretionary spending. The reality is we should be putting money into free education through college. That's how it should be. And not mediocre college either. And not mediocre college either, but real college education so people are able to adapt and be productive in this complicated world that we're living in. I think that will do a great deal to really move America forward in much more serious ways than we're moving now. As far as what I would do if I were in office about this, a couple things I'll just mention. One, I would not allow a vote on an appropriations of the military budget until we face up to the war power of the Congress. Unless a war is declared by Congress, they should not be voting for appropriations for a war. And I would do whatever I could to stop that kind of a vote, whether it's a filibuster or taking some kind of a approach that a single congressman, senator could take, I would do that. The second thing is I would take my role in the Senate as building on my 30-year history as an organizer. I've worked on a wide range of issues. Paperless voting is a big problem I've been working on recently. We're trying to get a paper trail for electronic voting, ending the war on drugs, social and economic justice, ending the Iraq war. Those are issues I've worked on and I care about. And I would bring the best organizers I could to the Senate and use my office as a foot in the door for the American people. Because we do not have a foot in the door in this Senate. We have a Senate, you know, John McCain is something I don't agree with all the time. But he says about our electoral system something I think is very true and I'm sure you'll agree with. And that is our Congress, our Senate, our electoral system is a massive influence peddling scheme where both parties conspire to sell the country to the highest bidder. Ernest Hollings was a little more blunt when he talked about the Senate on 60 Minutes. He described it as a house of prostitution. That Southern comment was pretty powerful. He said it, and it's a fiction to think they're just getting access. He says they're writing the bills. They're writing the bills, and we don't have a foot in the door. And so when Americans are surveyed, The Economist reported this in July, they're asked the question, do you feel represented by your elected officials in the federal government? Only 17% could say yes. 83% of Americans in the greatest supposed representative democracy on earth, 83% could not say they felt represented by their federal elected officials. We need a foot in the door, and if I'm in the Senate, I'm going to make sure that my foot is in the door for the American people. Now, I agree with what I'm going to close on this point. I agree with that the speakers all said we cannot wait for the elections. We need to act now. And I want to tell you that the support for ending the Iraq war, the opposition to the Bush administration, even support for impeachment, is widespread, not among just left activists, anti-war activists, but across the board. I was at an event recently where General William Odom spoke, and I was disturbed by his comments. He was very positive about U.S. empire, saying what a good thing it is for the world. General Odom was the national security advisor for President Reagan. He's a four-star general, and he's part of the foreign policy, you know, brain trust of the United States. He's the mainstream foreign policy. And when he was asked in the audience, what do we do, by the audience, what do we do to get control of the Bush administration, he says, how do you impeach? So if General Odom, someone who supports American empire, is talking about impeachment, I think we have an issue that has much more legs than we realize. I think, once again, the American people are ahead of our elected officials, and this is one more example of how our elected officials don't represent the interests of the American people.
You've been listening to a forum on impeachment held last week in Washington, D.C., moderated by Kevin Zeese of democracyrising.us, with panelists Marcus Raskin of the Institute for Policy Studies, former diplomat Anne Wright, former Attorney General Ramsey Clark, David Swanson of afterdowningstreet.org, and Cindy Sheehan of Gold Star Families for Peace. Our website is unwelcomeguest.org, and our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening. The rich will come.